Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Pearls of Wisdom. I'm Melissa Peskin, and I am here with Dr. Mitch Maimon. Welcome.
Hi. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Yeah, I'm excited. So this is, we're going to kick off our first real episode in the new format or the intended format for the podcast, which will hopefully be me interviewing people who, from all different generations, who did residency in the Bronx. So
it's such an exciting project. I'm so happy to be a part of it.
We're excited. I'm excited to start with you because I think you have a lot of perspective. I first figured that out after reading your book. What's your book's name?
Well, my first novel is called Every Third Night, and it might be the only novel ever written that takes place in an OBGYN residency program.
I wish I could say that's true, but actually there is a book called, I'm going to have to figure it out, but it's The Life of Dr. Montefiore, ironically. And it's written by this guy, Dr. Hirsch, and actually it's about a OBGYN residency in Chicago.
Is it a novel? Or is it fiction or nonfiction?
It's like a historical fiction, something like that. Mm. but actually there were a lot of similarities. Because I think that anyone who has done an OBGYN residency, probably regardless of the generation, has probably come into contact and experienced very similar.
Well, you things. People who did your residencies in the Bronx, even though the novel is set in a make-believe hospital in Manhattan, you might find a few similarities. You might pick up on a few things. So some of it might seem familiar to you.
Definitely. So tell me when you did residency.
My residency was from 1981 to 1985. I had graduated downstate medical school, class of 81, and I went to the match, and wasn't hoping to match in Albert Einstein. My first choice was to go to California. But I think it was my fourth choice, and I really didn't know much about it. And I grew up in Brooklyn, and I said to myself, I'm going to the Bronx.
You'll be a Bronx bomber regardless, right? All right, who's your baseball team?
It was the Yankees, but I couldn't take the big step. I'd actually moved to the Bronx, even though almost everybody who does a residency wants to live close to the hospital. So actually, I lived in Forest Hills in Queens. And I commuted to hospitals in the Bronx for 4 years.
Just to give an idea of, I guess, what was going on in 1984, how much was the tolls to get to the Bronx?
Oh, it was probably maybe like a dollar.
A dollar, and you took the Whitestone or the Throgs Neck?
Whitestone. It was pretty quick. Yeah, it was pretty quick. But you have to remember that in those days, the residency program that you guys call Albert Einstein today, it was called Bronx Municipal Hospital Center. And it included four hospitals that were all about equal. Einstein, which we call Weiler today, but it was Einstein, Jacoby, Montefiore, and NCB. And the crux of the program was Jacoby. Jacoby was where the administration was. Jacoby was real. Most of the program took place. All the academics took place. So it was very, very different then, especially going to four different hospitals.
Wow. That is wild. I did residency in 2008 to 2012, and we did not go to NCB really. But we did do a significant part of our residency at Jacoby, as well as Moses and Weiler. At that time, at least for the first couple years of the program, we had the labor floor at Jacoby, which was bananas. But not as bananas as the Weiler labor floor. But I think it was different in your day.
Oh, yeah. In my day, Weiler, which we called Einstein, was really not the biggest part of the program at all. It was a relatively small hospital. Labor floor was totally private. As a resident, you were a babysitter. And I hated it there. And in fact, I switched some of my rotations because I hated it there so much because I wanted to be independent. And whenever I could go to the West Campus, to Montefiore, I would. But remember, I went to medical school in Kings County. So when I got to Jacoby the first day, I thought that was the private hospital. I never saw a city hospital so nice, because if anybody's been to Kings County, I mean, in that day, anyway, it was a 1,200-bed hospital and 16-bed wards, one sink, one bar of soap. So I thought Jacoby was the nicest hospital I've ever seen, and someone had explained to me that it wasn't the private hospital.
Really? That's wild, because there are actually remnants of that old hospital at Jacoby, at least when I was a resident, where there were six patients to a room. And yeah, and then obviously over time they renovated and actually built that ambulatory wing and everything. But yeah, you can see the old school hospital still at Jacoby, and certainly the basement was crazy, and running from the labor floor down to the lab or to the blood bank was a mainstay of being an intern for sure. Wow. I think it's important to know the history of where you train. I just think history in general is so fascinating, and how things evolve. And if you don't look back, I had a history professor at Columbia tell me that history is the precipice for the future. And I hung on those words, and I think that that's even true. I think learning the history of where you're training or where you're evolving as a person or a doctor helps.
And again, as I already mentioned, Montefiore for me was the best rotation, because that was very surgical. We had a whole bunch of private guys who brought in cases. And I spent the first 2 months of my residency in medicine, because we had to do 2 months of medicine in our first year at that time. And then when I started, my first GYN rotation was in Montefiore. And I remember, you know, maybe a 6-8 weeks into it, was the first time I completed an operation myself. And that was a bilateral tubal ligation, which in those days was done open through a Fannin steel incision. In 1981 or two, laparoscopy was really not operative. It was diagnostic laparoscopy. And we were just beginning to use laparoscopy for tubal ligations with something called the Fallope ring, where we would slide the ring on. But it was really in its infancy. And most of the old timers, technology was too much for them. So your typical case was a Fannin steel incision and a tubal ligation. And then there was this attending who anybody at Einstein for the next 30 years after that probably knows, Dr. Vita. And Dr. Vita, one of these old time Italian guys, and he amazingly let me do my first operation from skin to skin. Probably took about an hour to do a whole tubal ligation. And I just remember the feeling when I finished that last stitch and just said to myself, I did an operation all by myself. And I think it was probably at that moment that I knew that I would have to be a surgeon over any other part of OBGYN, which obviously I wind up doing a GYN oncology fellowship. But that first feeling of doing an operation on a human being, obviously not by myself. I mean, he got it, everything I did, but it was just amazing.
Yeah, I have that same sentiment. I remember the first time, you know, in the beginning when the chiefs are always sort of hands behind you for a vaginal delivery, right? And they're just there to, you know, protect the perineum or catch the baby. And I remember one day, it felt like when you're learning to ride a bike, that I remember when I was learning to ride a bike, I remember looking behind me and realizing my mom wasn't holding on anymore. And same thing happened one day. My chief resident just didn't intervene, and I did the whole delivery sort of by myself. And I remember having that feeling of utter pride and accomplishment and sort of renewed purpose that, oh my gosh, I'm actually climbing the learning curve. I'm actually making progress in this, what seemed like interminable.
And there are so many times, during training that you feel that way, that you crossed another hurdle. And, you know, as hard as it is, it's a time where it's really the beauty of medicine, because you're learning your trade. And you're learning your trade under tough conditions, and it's wonderful. It really is. So those first feelings when someone like knows like they've been affected like that, I think it's great.
So that was the most memorable thing. What was the hardest thing about your residency?
You know, so I started my residency, and you know, I was pretty psyched. You know, I wanted to be a great doctor, and you know, I was young. I mean, I graduated college when I was 20. So I graduated medical school when I was 24. So that's when I started my residency. And I was an athlete and I was in good shape. And I mean, I thought I could handle anything. And then the first night on call, when you actually, well, most of the nights, but certainly this night, I didn't hit the bed. And then you woke up in the morning and I had to go to clinic for like 8 hours and it ran late. And I didn't get home till like 7 o'clock. And then I had to get into my car to commute over a bridge because I was living in Queens. And I looked at my on-call schedule they had just handed out. And I saw it 10 times in 30 nights, every third night, which is the title of my novel. And I just was up for 38, 40 hours. And I said to myself, I have to do this for 4 years. It was almost unimaginable. I mean, the second day in clinic, I didn't even think about anything. I mean, it, you know how you are after not hitting the bed. You just fizz out. And I said to myself, is this my life for 4 years? Save 4 weeks of vacation a year? And I just got a horrible feeling in the pit of my stomach and said to myself, oh my God, what did I get into? You know, remember, we graduate college and a lot of our friends, you know, go on and get jobs. And then we start this residency and they're working and making money and having some fun. And it's like we've disappeared off the face of the earth.
So what kept you going? I mean, obviously you probably thought twice about your decision, but what kept you going?
Well, I think that what kept me going was what keeps most of us going is that we want to do something great and we want to be a great doctor. And we see that if we could become that, the rewards will be far greater than the punishment. And also, like you said, Melissa, history. When we talked to guys before us, you know, the generation before us, they said they were on call every other night. What are you complaining about every third night? We were on call every other night. And then when you went back to the guys from the 50s, they said they lived in the hospital and they were on every night. So you got to see that you were in a spectrum of abuse and you weren't in the worst part of that spectrum. And then, you know, when you become an attending, and then when I was a chairman and all the residents are working over an 80-hour work week and they're complaining, you know, you have to hold back a little bit and say, well, that's what they're used to. But to go home the next day after being post-call, oh my God, what an advantage. What an advantage.
Yeah, I mean, even now as an attending, I don't have to work post-call. I couldn't even imagine going to see patients post-call. I've never had to do that. Thank goodness. I definitely would not take a job that expected me to do that, because I know that I will put every single ounce of energy into my work when I'm in the hospital, but certainly in that morning is my witching hour and I get ornery and I need to recoup. I need to recover. So I don't know how you guys did it.
Well, and I think the challenge is for all of us is that how do you try to be at your best when you can't be at your best? And if I think of the 10 worst times I was ever at my worst in life, I'm sure the first 9 out of 10 were when I was a resident up all night. It's just hard. And I think about the mistakes I ever made, and most of them involve sleep deprivation.
Yeah, I think once you get to a breaking point with sleep deprivation, I think it's impossible to regulate your emotions. It's like a bad drug. It's not great. So.
Well, the organization that led to the changes was called the Bell Commission. And that really started to kick in a little bit in the next few years after I finished my residency. And then you started seeing for the first time some duty hours restrictions. But for us, from 81 to 85, it was too little too late.
Do you think, though, that's sort of as the pendulum swings back and forth over the years, especially with regards to medicine and medical education, do you think that there is a downside to not sort of seeing either a case through or a labor progress through in the effort to really comply with those hours? Do you think that they're missing something by not by sort of being forced to go home?
Yes, there is a downside, particularly in following a labor patient. And that should be an exception for the resident who is with somebody all night and she's 9 centimeters and then has to go home. And we're too inflexible, especially in the climate that we all know that in surgical and OB-GYN residencies, we have 80-hour work weeks, but there's still a lot of abuse and people are not adhering to that, you know. So we know that it looks good on paper, but we know, but being a chairman myself, I know of so many programs that, particularly surgical, that don't follow that and either lie about it or even take a fine if they have to. But there should be some exceptions, and those exceptions should be following an OB or a immediately post-op surgical patient who's having a complication. And we've been too rigid. But you understand that the organizations that have to monitor it have to be rigid to protect against the cheating.
Oh, sure. Everything, there's slippery slopes in there, right? So I can appreciate that. Okay, so minus the sleep, what was the craziest thing you ever saw in the Bronx?
Well,
and I'm gonna make a wager that I have seen a similar thing, because I think I've seen almost everything. But go ahead.
The craziest thing I've ever seen. I would say that probably my first time I saw a delivery of unexpected second twin.
Oh, okay. No, I haven't had that, but I talk about it.
So, you know, we didn't, in 1981 to 85, everybody didn't get ultrasounds. People would commonly go through an entire pregnancy sometimes with ultrasound. And in the Bronx, we got a lot of patients who came in with no prenatal care. And sometimes it was the first time we were seeing them. And you didn't know the patient. So, first time I saw something like this, and might be the only time, is, you know, a patient delivered the first baby. And we only had reason to believe there was only one baby. She wasn't particularly big. Maybe her dates were off, so we thought she was a little premature when she wasn't. And the baby was born, and people are getting ready to move on and go on to the next thing. And the husband or boyfriend is, you know, hanging out. And the woman starts saying something in Spanish that very few of us understood, and holding a stomach, and she's talking about pain, and we're all thinking she's abrupting, or something's happening to her, rupturing her uterus. I mean, again, we don't know anything about the lady. She could have been a previous section for all we know, all right? And all of a sudden, it became apparent, no, there's another baby coming out. And her face, and the husband's face, and the resident's face, i.e. me, and whoever else was in the room, we rarely had attendings in the room at that point. And to see another baby come out, and everybody look, and everybody was healthy, it was really something else. It was a moment you'll never forget.
Right. I'm sure no one was monitoring that baby.
Nobody was monitoring it. And that brings up a whole nother topic of how we monitor. But it was very joyous. And obviously very lucky that everybody was healthy.
Oh, that is wild. We've had patients come in who didn't know they were pregnant. The young girl who was hiding it or just sort of in denial. We've had that. I saw a lady who did not know she was pregnant, and when she delivered, her baby was found to be anencephalic, and there was a shoulder dystocia. So the person who went to go, and she came in precipitously, just screaming. She didn't really know she was pregnant, so she went to the emergency room, and the emergency room saw something, and they sent her quickly to labor and delivery, and I'll never forget, she went to the room, and the patient is screaming. And the head is it possible it's crowning? It doesn't have a back of a head, but basically whatever. So the head comes out, and the person, the doctor or PA who went to go deliver the baby couldn't negotiate the shoulder. And so as she turned the baby to try to do like a wood screw, she discovered the baby didn't have a cranium.
Oh, God.
Yeah, it was pretty morbid. So, yes, they delivered the baby, and unfortunately it passed.
Well, you know, the stories that Melissa and I are telling, all subspecialties have amazing stories and highs and lows. There's nothing quite like OBGYN, which is why it's the most wonderful of all fields. The emotion of OBGYN, the topics that we take care of, the issues, are so emotional, so volatile. Fetal anomalies, having a baby, cancer, infertility, abortion, genetic abnormalities. I mean, the whole range of all the most emotional medical issues you could possibly imagine. And no field has anything close to it compared to OBGYN. And I think that's why when we buy into it, we're all in. And everybody else who's not an OBGYN does not understand how we could possibly go into it. So OBGYN is made up of everybody who completely drank the Kool-Aid and everybody else who can't relate at all.
At all, yeah, no, it's so...
It's filled with emotion.
Yeah, emotion and versatility and diversity of topics and problems. I mean, the spectrum of things that we see and cover, I mean, from oncology, right, to... you know, to like, right, taking out everyone's organs and full pelvic exenteration, right? Mm. To the patient who ends up with the cesarean hysterectomy, to the girl who doesn't like the size of her labia, you know? Or certainly you mentioned abortion and all of the difficult things that we have to discuss. So it could be super happy and people associate happiness with our field. But certainly there's some trials and tribulations.
You have to be a little bit of a psychologist or a psychiatrist to be an OBGYN.
Or psychotic.
You know, the only reason I went to medical school was to become a psychiatrist. You know, I was a psych major in college. My thesis was in Freud. And when I got to downstate, I only thought I'd be a psychiatrist. Nothing else even crossed my mind. And then you get to practice psychiatry in the way we know it, medical psychiatry, and you see it's not all dream analysis on a couch. And even in the 1980s, it was drugs, it was schizophrenia. And then I spent a couple of nights on the G building in Kings County, which was the psych ward where Son of Sam was being held. I had to make rounds on him one day. He was his medical student.
No.
So I got into medical school. By my second year, I said, I need to find another field. And not knowing it at the time, I think I came the closest I could to psychiatry by going into OBGYN.
That is amazing. I would love to hear more about the Son of Sam, but that's kind of terrifying, actually.
Well, Kings County was a very terrifying place, let me tell you.
All right. What do you think was the earliest lesson you learned as a doctor, a practicing doctor?
The earliest lesson. I think that be aware of what you don't know. I think that, you know, being a very kind of confident, arrogant, the young man, so young, you're doing residency, you're always doing well on my exams and things like that, people usually complimenting you. You can get really full of yourself. And I think I spent the rest of my career never being too full of myself, no matter what I seemingly accomplished. Because when you make that one or two mistakes and a patient pays for it, you never forget it. And I think I made some of those mistakes when I was young, particularly when I was sleep deprived. And I don't think I ever lost a patient because of it, but I certainly, patients' outcomes were affected. And I think you have to be humbled early. And I think that medicine will humble you. It will humble every one of us. But to be humbled, you have to have a receptive mind. And you have to be receptive to the fact that you'll never know everything. And there's always going to be someone a little smarter than you. So be humble, consider everything. And I think that really made me adopt a very critical thinking for the rest of my career, where I never ruled out every possibility. You know, I spent a good part of my career really as a teacher and educator. I think that was probably the most important part of my career. And whenever residents would come in and tell me they have a diagnosis, I would say, well, what's second, third, and fourth? Okay. For some reason today, I think we lose the differential diagnosis. Residents come in and say what the patient has.
Right.
Not that this is what I think they have, 80%, but is the 10% and the 8% and the 6%. And you have to be humbled early and you have to be receptive about what you don't know, and being a physician is a big part of that.
I'm so glad you said that. I think that's one of the things that I say all the time, or at least feel that you need humility. We absolutely don't have control over everything, but we have to be able to anticipate as much as we can, and we have to be able to identify and recognize when things go differently or awry. How do you think, you mentioned maybe making mistakes, how do you cope with making sort of a pretty bad mistake, something that might harm somebody? Has that ever happened to you?
Sure. So I think it's happened to anybody who said they've never made a mistake in medicine and they've never harmed somebody is just either totally out of it or not telling the truth. You have to be affected by that if you care. And in OBGYN, I think most of us, we care. I think a lot of surgical personalities, both in our field and surgical personalities in the surgical field, they seem to be able to make themselves more immune than we can. All right. And certainly in human oncology, I probably saw more of that than in the other subspecialties. So we have to care. And if we care, then when we make mistakes, we have to make a commitment to improving. I think that's really a lesson in life. When you make mistakes in life, Melissa, you can ask me the same question. What do you do when you make a mistake in life? Okay, how do you improve? How do you change?
Well,
do you sit there and sulk?
Right.
Or do you say, how am I going to get better?
Actually, you know, I pore over things a lot, and I always want to get better. And actually, I was just telling my son about this, and I showed him a poster of Michael Jordan that I have in my house, and it says, always make a positive situation out of a negative situation. And I live by that, I think. I really just want to get better at my craft. I want to be better for the people around me. And so I tell people to be intentional about what they're doing. And I think that the same goes not only in life, as you said, but also in medicine, and to do your due diligence and be really pragmatic. And if you don't have an answer for everything, if it wasn't textbook, at least have a good rationale for why you're doing what you're doing. And that involves getting a lot of information from the patient. And even, as you said, know what you don't know. So ask other people for help.
Well, being a physician is not like a regular job. It's not like any other job. You know, you make a mistake and you're in the financial sector and somebody loses money. You know, you make a mistake in so many other fields and people don't pay for it with their health or their lives. And we have to recognize that, and we have to examine the reasons we went into medicine. And certainly if you went into medicine to make a lot of money, that was a mistake. Certainly now more than ever, that's not the way to go. But we have to understand that we're doing one of my best mentors once said to me, we do God's work. And we have to recognize the responsibility we have in taking care of other human beings.
Yeah, to me, that's everything. The onus. When I see a resident nowadays, the first thing that occurs to me is, are they taking full responsibility? And when I see somebody think about a patient after hours, or follow up on the case after hours, or go to extensive lengths to really ensure that the patient got the best care, is getting good follow-up, that's when I know that someone is in it. Right. You know, that's when I see the passion.
And we want people to have that type of burning desire, because there's so much at stake.
Right. There's so much at stake. I want to see those people really bend over backwards and take pride in what they're doing, and recognize that burden in a lot of ways, the
right.
privilege, the burden, and the onus.
Well, what you're describing really is what we're highlighting, residency training. You know, OBGYN, those 4 years, if you do a fellowship, another two or three more, and it's just a very volatile time where some of the bricks of the building that are being established in someone's career are so important. And as teachers, we have the ability to affect that. Let's not forget that. We have the ability. These are our children. These are our children. And just like your own children, okay, you have something to say about how they're going to turn out.
Right. And hopefully you can be a positive influence. But it's hard. It's not always an easy process, right? I mean, there are times when it's a hard truth. You know, truth is hard. Learning can be hard. Going through difficult situations is hard. Being told constantly that you have to refine or redo or figure it out better next time, write it better, ask different questions, do all of those things. Those are hard lessons to learn on a daily basis.
So we have to find a way around that in a very flawed medical system and make our individual contributions to try to combat that poison.
How do you suppose we do that when you have the volume, patient needs that are constantly banging at the door?
Well, as educators and attendings, we have to reach every single resident in our program. Somebody has to, all right? And look at them as people and see what they're going through. I can't tell you, Melissa, how many residents' careers I saved, okay, as a chairman and even before that, who are on the verge of having a breakdown, leaving medicine, even committing suicide. In my first year as an intern, we had three residents in Manhattan alone who killed themselves, three interns. The emotional stress is unbelievable. So, you know, faculties are large, and we all have to take on individual residents and get to know them as people and see what they're operating under, so they can thrive. So that's our charge.
I think that the impact that we have, we can get, you know, a lot of physicians have burnout, but I think you mentioned a really good point, is that we're all human. We all have stuff actually affecting us outside of the hospital. We also have all different personalities, different temperaments, and different ways of processing information that may not be understandable to everyone around us. I do think it's challenging in the heat of things, you know, when you really need to just take care of the patient, to always acknowledge that. But if you can get to know the people with whom you're working, then that probably does make people feel safer and just in the environment where they're working.
And the same formula doesn't necessarily be applied to every resident. Residents are different people. Some residents you can embarrass, and some residents you can be hard on and they'll respond. Others, if you take that stance, you'll crush them.
Right.
Okay? And they'll never be the same.
Right.
So it's not about you. That's making it about you. This is my way I'm going to teach, and everybody's going to go in line. Okay? You have to see what you can hit upon to get to, okay, and hit that nerve in a resident to make them thrive.
Right.
And that's the difference between an autocrat and a leader.
Right. Leadership. I went to a leadership conference, and one of the most impactful things that I learned was that while I see that, you know, a clear line between A and B, somebody else who's on the journey may take actually a very strayed way, you know, like a very long time or a different, you know, course to get from A to B. And it's possible, you know, and so you have to acknowledge that people are on their journey and you can't force that for them. You can guide them, you can give them signposts, you can give them sort of, you know, get them back into the onto the path towards the, you know, from that, from A to that B, but you can't do it for them, and they may go astray, but as long as you can help them along, then even if it takes them a while to get there, as long as they get there, that's what
right. And you know, you said you were at a leadership conference, so that means you're in a position of leadership.
Oh,
but who teaches people how to be leaders? Who teaches how to be teachers?
Right.
I mean, I happened to grow up that my father was a teacher, and I was teaching since I was in high school myself. But then just because you have knowledge doesn't mean you know how to teach.
That's
just
true.
Because you're a great surgeon doesn't mean you know how to teach surgery in the OR. Matter of fact, some of the best surgeons I ever worked with, okay, were the worst teachers because they did the operation themselves.
Right.
All right. And of course, being a leader means you're interacting with hospital administrations and try negotiating that. Who's teaching you how to do that? You're going to go back and take care of residents. But do they understand what you have to go through in negotiating your way, your career, with the hospital administrators and their different priorities? So it's all very, very complicated. And it requires openness, and it requires communication and support.
Right. I wish there were more hours in the day to be able to accomplish all these things. We used to have a little coffee cart that would come on the labor floor. And it was the value of this was so incredible, because everybody would just pause and be like, and ask for their cup of coffee or their hot cocoa or, you know, a cheese dish or whatever. And just everybody would stop for that moment,
right,
and sort of congregate around food, you know, and take a breath.
Well, it's great to congregate around food.
Yeah.
Those type of little things, those type of little gestures go a long way in making residents feel like they're really a part of something.
I mean, we have conferences that get food delivered. Most of the conferences in residency, we didn't have food delivered. Every once in a while, like Grand Rounds, we would have like a little bit of coffee and maybe a light breakfast. But then you go and you grab it and then you sit and listen to the lecturer. But yeah, when you have food, you can grab a lot more people right. and get them to come.
And I can't even imagine what the COVID era did, you know, to eye-to-eye communication. I mean, and from what I mean, luckily I had just retired before COVID, so I didn't have to live through that. But I even hear today that many times departments, grand rounds, are just now not given live.
Right.
I mean, they or lectures, residents, but even grand rounds, speaker come in from another institution, you shake hands, you meet them. I mean, what was more important than that? And now it could be all video conference.
Right.
It's just, are you kidding me? It's
no.
just not the same.
No, you lose that human
right.
connection.
Right.
Actually, it's interesting because, you know, everything is computerized now. And where I am right now, there's something called Secure Chat. And this is how it sort of takes over from the pager. And so people actually don't even talk on the phone anymore. They just Secure Chat. And that definitely was very different than my residency, where if I needed something done, yes, I could call, but it was actually probably faster to run to the other ward or unit or whatever, and or to find the person I was looking for and speak to them directly. And I find that the impersonal nature of the secure chat actually is worse for patient care, because things get lost in translation. Certainly the tone of how you text gets lost. And so I miss speaking to people face to face or even on the phone. Because I just, in that way, you can't not get your point across. You can't, it's just so much, I don't know.
Well, you're absolutely right, Melissa. Communication is everything. 99% of all mistakes in medicine are made because of a lack in communication or commission of facts. Maybe 1% or less of mistakes made in medicine are because someone didn't come up with some great diagnosis, okay? It's all the transfer of information and communication among colleagues and nobody knowing who the patient is and too many people, you know, taking care of the patient compared to the old days where one patient had one doctor. And that's why I'm so glad that in these sessions you've committed to interviewing a whole range of people of and a range of ages, because there's much to be learned about learning how things used to be done compared to how they're done today. And while many of them are negatives, I would bet there's probably more positives.
Yeah, I try to take things from the old times and make... Well, I believe medicine is an art. And my art that I want, you know, to say that I practice sort of harks from the past, right? This sort of old view of obstetrics, but integrating the new evidence that has become more clear and clarified in terms of how to treat patients. But I do value that old view of how of the relationship and the intimacy between a physician and their patient, as opposed to treating them like numbers or rooms or patients on a sign out.
And you also have to know about the history of your field.
Right.
I mean, in OBGYN, when I was a resident, fetal monitoring was really first beginning. I mean, I had plenty of attendings who never had any other way to monitor a patient but listening to the heartbeat every 15 minutes. And then fetal monitoring came in, continuous fetal monitoring. And, you know, the history of our specialty in that regard is not a good one. I mean, fetal monitoring came in and it became a standard of care before any scientific data really justified its use. And we were there as this was happening. And everybody had to be monitored. And then we didn't understand what the patterns really meant.
Right.
And I mean, how many times today when... What percentage of babies who are sectioned for, quote, fetal distress, okay, come out with 9, 10 APGARs?
Right.
90? 95? 98%?
Well, that's
and then the doctor comes out and goes to the parents, oh, we got it just in time. No, you didn't need it, okay? And so what happened to fetal monitoring when we... was adapted for full-time use before the scientific data justified its use? Malpractice, okay? It became a standard of care, and then it became part of medical malpractice, And then OBGYNs had to start changing the way they practice because of not going to get sued when everything is done for the name of the baby
right.
and a healthy baby. So now the woman who has a C-section times 3 or 4 and has a hemorrhage and a cesarean hysterectomy or dies, okay, does anybody go back to her first C-section, which she didn't need, that was done for a ridiculous indication like failure to progress, and say, let's sue that person for this person's death? No, that doesn't happen, all right, because this is 3/4 C-sections later. So it's important to know how your subspecialty and your specialty got there, because then you're really learning about some of the problems you're having in your subspecialty today. And then no one would argue that an OB, medical malpractice, is not the probably the biggest one.
Oh, 100%. And to your point, there is no actual evidence. Actually, it's evidence to the contrary that fetal heart rate monitoring has really not helped reduce the rate of CP. It's helped
right.
increase the cesarean
right.
section rate. And we're working now, I would like to, you know, toot my own horn, we're working now to try to safely prevent cesarean section among, you know, both nulliparous and people with 1 to 2 prior cesareans. But it is a uphill battle, and it takes a lot of convincing, and we are slaves to this fetal monitoring. And I think I heard Dr. Chapa actually talk about the Japanese model for interpreting the heart rate. They have 5 categories as opposed to our 3 categories. But if you read Stephen Clark's article called Castles in the Air, you'll come away not wanting to put one more baby on that monitor, because it's
right.
just, it really pokes holes in the whole myth.
Well, the C-section rate was always my pet peeve as a chairman, even though I was a GYN oncologist. I remained so passionate about that. And I remember an article being written in the New York Times about our hospital, where the C-section rate was 18%, and the other hospital in Staten Island, where the C-section rate was 40%. And it was called like a tale between two hospitals.
Oh my gosh.
And this is the same type of patient population, the same ratio of service to private patients, just a total difference in leadership and philosophy. Okay. And, you know, C-section fetal monitoring, it's not the only story. There are multiple stories in OB where we went wrong. I mean, look at breech delivery.
Right.
Okay. Now we can't even talk about it because we don't know how to deliver breeches because we lost the training. There aren't enough doctors who really do know how to take care of a breech patient for a vaginal delivery correctly. So that battle is lost. But anybody who was around in an early era knows that a properly selected patient for a breech delivery is completely safe. All right? It has to be properly selected, and the manager needs to know how to deliver a breech, which is basically keep your hands off the patient.
Ah, that's
all
what
right?
I say. That's
I mean,
what I say.
Not that hard.
Did you read
right?
my book?
But so again, what we're talking about here is loving and knowing the history of your own specialty, not because just it's interesting, because it answers some of the questions and the dilemmas that you grapple with today.
Right. Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. All right. We're about to wrap up. This was fascinating. My last question is, do you have any memory of an M&M that you did in residency?
Yes.
Okay. Last story.
Going back a long time ago.
Yes.
We had a patient who had a pregnant lady who had a heart condition, serious heart condition. And it was a big controversy about when she should be delivered and how she should be delivered. And I forget what a heart defect. It might have been a tight mitral stenosis. I mean, so she was a very sick person. And like everything else in my residency, people divided up into 2 camps. So one attending, wanted to do this, and another attending said, don't do this, do that. And I, without going into the details, but I remember just my understanding at the time, and I wasn't a young then, I might have been a chief, all right? And I clearly thought one way was the way to go. And we went the other way, and we were sitting in M&M after she died. And that doesn't necessarily mean that... if we went the other way, she wouldn't have had a bad outcome too. Like I said, she was sick, all right? But I felt pretty strongly that it was the wrong choice, and now the woman passed away. And I saw that so many times after that in my career in GYN oncology. wrong decision. You know, being, I think, one time in my career where I actually saw a patient bleed to death on the table, which is every GYN oncologist's nightmare. And luckily it wasn't my patient, but it was a colleague. And God, what a horror show. And the decision was, should she be going to the OR or not? You know, a recurrent sarcoma. And clearly I didn't think so. And again, this is not someone who's going to live to be 100 anyway. She was going to die from this disease, but not that day on the table.
Right.
So yeah, the M&Ms really remind you of how fragile everything is and how our decision-making has a direct impact on outcome. Take it seriously. It's not a game. Take it seriously and be open-minded.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Maiman. I really, really appreciate that. And I couldn't agree more. So maybe I am old school. Maybe I was born too late.
Anyway. Well, Melissa, you go from new school to old school very quickly in life.
Yeah, I guess so. All right, well, we're going to sign off. Until next time.
And thank you. It was great talking to you.
Yeah, you too.